Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Happy year-end holiday onset week to all, considering the circumstances. Two guests today, Jamie McCallum will talk to us about the sorrows of work, and Jeff Stein about the emerging Biden national security crew. What an eventful week in an eventful year. Trump finally threw in the towel, though without conceding, that helped drive the Dow Jones Industrial Average past 30,000. The investor class welcomes the passing of all the chaos and its replacement by a moderate regime that won't expropriate it. Tesla stock has been a star of the bull run, up more than sixfold so far this year, the latest surge powered by the news that it will join the Standard & Poor's 500 stock index. Since vast pots of money are managed just to match that index's performance, money managers will be plowing fresh cash into the stock, helping to drive it still higher. Tesla barely makes a profit. Its stock is nonetheless valued at over $500 billion, well above the combined values of Toyota, Volkswagen, GM, Ford, and Honda. It's selling about 500,000 cars a year, 40% less than Toyota sells in a month. But it's got the magic aura of a tech stock, which gives it that half-trillion-dollar valuation. Meanwhile, 13 million Americans are about to lose their unemployment benefits. What a glorious moment to be alive. My first guest is Jamie McCallum, author of Worked Over, How Round-the-Clock Work is Killing the American Dream, just out from Basic Books. It's a close-up look at the labor market today, where unemployment is mixed with overwork, where workers are underpaid and constantly monitored, and live at the mercy of the boss. McCallum is a professor of sociology at Middlebury College. Jamie McCallum. The U.S. economy seems to be afflicted, I guess others too, but this really is very prominent to me in looking at the U.S. economy, with these twin contradictory characteristics, overwork and underwork. We hear about unemployment as a problem, which it certainly is, but then people with jobs are just working their fingers to the bone and have nothing to show for it. So what about these two broad phenomena? How do they fit together, this overwork and underwork?
Yeah, that was the central dynamic that interested me when I first started thinking about this project. Because on the one hand, as you said, you have an across-the-board rise of everyone in the past 40-some years working significantly more, like about five extra weeks since the 70s. And at the same time, you have not really a rise, but a significant sort of stagnation in like what they call voluntary unemployment since the Great Recession. So a lot of people who want more hours. This even appears on like protest placards where like Walmart strikers carry signs that say, you know, we demand more hours at work, which is such a stark difference than you think about the shorter hours movement from 60, 70 years ago. One of the main reasons is just that maybe simply there is some benefit to employers to working certain workers longer than hiring more people for fewer hours altogether. And I think that's one of the reasons. I think there's also a rise in long hour occupations, like a trend toward certain kinds of occupations that would require longer hours. The other thing that would mix that up, I think, would be something in the middle. That would be an increase in the sort of unpredictability and precarious scheduling of other people. So those three dynamics, long hours, not enough, and unpredictability and schedule volatility were the kind of temporal changes, I guess, that interested me.
Where did they come from? When did they start showing up and why?
The rise in longer hours begins, like there's a long period, obviously, of decline in hours. Like if you look at sort of capitalist history, right, you get this like thing where people 100 and some years ago were working much more hours than they were today. However, that decline, which is fairly steady, begins to change around the 1970s. So in the mid-70s, you get a reversal of a trend. And that, to me, obviously corresponds with changes in the sort of classic transformation of capitalism from a more of a welfare state model to a neoliberal model, one that puts the squeeze on unions, which were historically the agents that got people fewer hours. So as the attack on unions begins to increase the ability of them to perform what was basically their historic mission of more money for fewer hours also begins to erode.
That time period, the mid-70s, is also when the real hourly wage peaked in its value. Do these things go together?
Yeah, right. Another reason why I guess we'd see extended hours is that people begin to not being able to afford to work less. Now, there did seem to be some elective value in working less for much of the mid-20th century. And there's some evidence, like popular opinion polls and these kinds of things, that suggest that changes. And so, in fact, we hear a lot about overworked professionals, white-collar people like doctors, lawyers, tech people, whatever else. And those people do work more hours than most other people. However, it's the hours of low-income workers that shifted the most, like basically about 25% over the last few decades. And studying that shift was what interested me the most. And so as you see sort of a rise in inequality, a decline in unionization, and an increase sort of in precarious work, you get longer hours among lower income people.
Yeah, it is curious, though, that Veblen's leisure class has largely disappeared. The upper classes don't clip coupons. They take pride in working around the clock.
Right. That is weird. And I think there's a million explanations or a few explanations for it. I was most interested in one that is, you probably know more of those than I do. It's my understanding that the returns, like that the percentage of people who are basically rich and working has increased, and that the returns on work are far greater, obviously, at the top end of the spectrum than they are at the bottom. In other words, like the value of their time is significant, more significant than it is at the bottom. However, as I also understand it, those people have pulled away from the rest of the labor force, not by working longer hours, which would be, it's simply impossible to work more hours to earn so much money, but by higher incomes. And so I think there's two things really, whereas incomes at the top begin to increase exponentially, the commitment to work, just like for bonuses and for premium pay, begins to have an effect on people and begins to pull people toward longer hours. And then there's also a cultural, I think, explanation, which is around, you know, the value of a person becomes more attached to the work they're doing rather than the leisure they're getting. And that's sort of a different animal, but I think also is probably at play a little bit.
Yeah, I want to return to that theme, the meaning of work, in a moment. But you have a chapter on the evolution of scientific management. Taylor, whose name is associated with it, who is a bit of a fraud, but nonetheless his name is associated with it. And this development of controlling, the centerpiece of it is controlling the workers' time and movements. What did that do to the nature of work and the way we think of work and approach it?
Right. This kind of history is what is pretty significant, I think. You know, a lot of recent labor history after Harry Braverman and whatever began looking more at Taylor. I happen to be from Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, where Taylor worked at Bethlehem Steel and performed some of his most historic experiments, if you want to call it that. He did two things which were most crucial, I think. First, he figured out that work is not just an art form that is carried out over the length of a day. And it's actually a series of tasks and actions and minuscule moments that can be measured and quantified and transformed. And so once the labor process or labor time becomes highly sort of individuated, then you can control each little part of it. And so the term scientific management, I think, was coined by someone else, even though he is associated with it. And is really about the breakdown of a work day or a work week into minuscule parts. And it becomes easier then to say, okay, well, this particular task should take this amount of time. And it's much easier to manage and measure that than it is to say, over the course of a week, we want this kind of output, let's say. The other thing he did, I think, which does matter in this case, which is not only to transform the way the time is measured, but the way that skill is looked at. And if workmen were, or work people were formerly considered, you know, craftsmen or skilled or whatever, Taylor's genius was to transfer that skill to management by de-skilling the process, by removing some of the technical and craft-oriented components of a lot of industrial work and mechanize it, break it down into smaller and smaller parts. Today, when people see Taylorism in the workplace, they, you know, look at the way that smaller apportionments of a worker's day is accounted for and is measured and can be much more easily controlled. For example, like even teachers, which is the kind of occupation which we really socially do not want to Taylorize. You know, how much time do you spend course planning? Or what do you do during recess? Like those kinds of things are routinely asked of all kinds of workers now. And I think it's a legacy of scientific management.
Taylor may be gone, and Taylorism may be a bit of a relic. But on the other hand, you write really scarily about all these productivity monitoring technologies that Amazon workers are fitted with. What are those like? What's it like to work under those conditions?
Right. These new suite of new productivity enhancing, allegedly productivity enhancing devices are an outgrowth of Taylorism and are sort of an example of digital or modern Taylorism. So what's interesting about these things, that there are, for example, if you are, you know, using a company-issued laptop or a company-issued cell phone or whatever, and you work in a white-collar office, there's a reasonable chance that there's installed spyware on there to monitor what you do. That can access your webcam and access your keystrokes and your social media presence and all kinds of things. The history there is that it was sort of first tried out on subcontractors, like people beyond the eye of company culture, that we looked warily on them and they said, okay, let's monitor them. There's at least like some semblance of a rationale. And then it was apparently fairly successful in like showing who was slacking off, who wasn't, and we could use that to admonish people or to administer raises or whatever. And then it began tried out on everyone else who was at the company already. Let's just see what they're doing during the day. The pandemic, interestingly, has really exploded this phenomena because everyone's working from home. So now everyone sort of has the conditions of being a subcontractor. And so some of the main companies like Hubstaff or TimeCop or...
TimeCop.
I know, it's amazing.
That's an amazing name.
Right. There's even one called Wiretap. Like, how did you even come up with these names? And they're experiencing an explosive growth in their use right now. Looking at it from an individual standpoint of well, this is an invasion of my privacy, is obviously significant. The other way to look at it is basically a function of class weakness. Like, there were movements in the 80s and 90s and 2000s to resist some forms of electronic surveillance. Most of them were defeated. So today we've come to accept this as normal. So I was interested in looking at it from the standpoint of not just individuals' lack of privacy, but as the inability of workers to really fight back against it.
I'm speaking with the sociologist Jamie McCallum, author of Worked Over, just out from Basic Books. Now, of course, with the proliferation of all these self-help books and consultants and various hucksters of that sort, have we internalized Taylorism now, or do we have the time and motion guy inside our head?
Yeah. So I think that's interesting. I wrote this chapter, and the basic argument was, as you're suggesting, that, you know, we went from a moment where our work was sort of measured for us and we resisted it to a time when we are either Taylor or Schmidt, the person he studied, and it's tough to figure out which. And at times, I think that's definitely true. Like, there's obvious ways in which, you know, the idea of, for example, just time management as a unconditional or unquestioned social good that exists outside of work, even, is probably also a legacy of that sort of Taylorist philosophy. That's not to say there's not a lot of pushback on that, but I think that in our general lives, a lot of people have have internalized that clock, that productivity and efficiency and making the most of our day is a good and a something to strive for, even outside of work time. And so I studied like things like different kinds of apps and even parenting strategies that sort of promote a sort of a clocked or a monitored life outside of work time.
Yeah, I mean, there's some appalling stories in there, like, Marissa Mayer wanting to work 100 hours a week during her alleged maternity leave, or that woman who left a sounded like a pretty comfortable job with Visa in Manhattan to go to San Francisco and take up a 9 a.m. to 10 p.m. day.
Right.
Do these people, it's kind of a banal hippie question to me to ask, but are they happy? Does this make them happy?
I don't know. I mean, I think so. There is, I think, two points on this. There are a large degree of public opinion polls, like, you know, Gallup's poll and Pew's poll, that show people are disconnected from the workplace. However, there are also indications that people, you know, people do actually, the cynical position that, oh, we're just sort of slaves and that, work is dragging us down, it's obviously true to some degree, but there's a lot of evidence that people really do seem, I mean, Studs Terkel documented this decades ago, that people do get a lot of satisfaction, self-realization, fulfillment, knowledge, through the workday. And there's been other studies that have shown that, you know, as home life becomes more stressful with the demise of the sort of social wage and the rise of the independent wage, like the double family earner household is stressful. Even if it's a step forward in certain arenas, culturally, people tend to shelter at work and they stay there for longer periods of time. So I think that I'm not sure if we can say if people are happy or not, but I think there are powerful incentives to try to find happiness in that environment. So if you're pushed to work more and more and more, I think there are incentives to rationalize it as good. And I found that people sort of tended to do that.
Now, of course, you go back into the 70s with the blue-collar blues era, the Lordstown factory of GM, where workers were rebelling against the meaninglessness. They wanted some meaning in their jobs, and they didn't want to be so alienated and miserable. And now, 40, 50 years later, the use of this do-what-you-love thing or find meaning in the job has taken on a kind of sinister angle as well as being something that you positively want.
Yeah, that's right. So I found this really fascinating, this particular little question. There has been a couple of years now, for a decade maybe, people have been interested in this sort of do-what-you-love ideology. And you know, they attribute it to people like Steve Jobs, who are basically sort of pulling the wool over your eyes, you know, saying, oh, I do what I love. Meanwhile, hiring people in China to produce all kinds of, you know, all his gadgets. And I think that's a reasonable critique of it. However, I was interested, I guess, in like a material foundation for it, I suppose. And so there was all this activity in the 70s and into the 80s of industrial workers demanding better jobs. And, you know, the sort of Lordstown issues you raise about strikes and shutdowns and slowdowns and sick outs and sort of the hippieification of the industrial working class was real. And they really rejected, first and foremost, the monotony and the doldrums of the workplace. The critique of the do what you love ideology misses the fact that actually for a very long time, like, people really do want and deserve meaningful work. And so the question then becomes like, how do you get it? Or what kinds of things can we do to really win it? Because we see the same thing with white collar workers. Like, for a while, we thought that the office was a reasonable alternative to the factory. And that if you got an office job, you'd made it out of your blue collar neighborhood or whatever. But that didn't seem to be true either. And all those tech gurus, you know, were really influential in promoting the idea that work could be much more than this. I'm not saying they were sincere all the time in the way they deployed it, but there was a kernel of truth in that I think is worth remembering. So I became interested in that dilemma which is, you know, sort of those echoes of it in David Graeber's last book, the bullshit jobs argument, that people really were searching for something that they weren't finding. So it's like, how can we get it? And that became some interesting little avenue for me to explore.
You mentioned that one of the reasons you wrote the book was that you were trying to investigate your own political commitment to reducing work hours. At the same time, you yourself work very hard. And I've noticed this in other people I've interviewed on the topic, like Jim Livingston and Kathy Weeks. These are people who both themselves spend a lot of time on their academic and writing work and political yes. work, too. Yet, you know, they advocate this no work or less work agenda. Did you figure this out? Have you reconciled these contradictions?
No, I think not. But I think it is a common one. Well, especially in academia, because obviously, like, you know, you can always be sort of on. And at the same time, like, my job is pretty cushy. And a lot of people can easily do this job in much less time. I've had that poster on my wall that's like says, I didn't go to work today. I don't think I'll go tomorrow. We should start living for pleasure or something. I don't know. Some sort of old, like, sort of anarchist sloganeering. And it does seem to me to be important that we organize society in such a way that people have access to a dignified life without working all the time. And it also is clear to me that people who say they like to work less also report the desire to be very socially useful in their communities. Like the movement for shorter hours is often, I think, considered to be about rest rather than about politics or about finding time for other kinds of things. So me personally, I think that I have not fully embraced the sort of like leisure thing, but I also, the book isn't just written for me. It's like, it's really about giving people more power. We're thinking about ways to give more people more power and freedom to be able to have that option. And right now I do have that option for the most part. I think I probably exercise it less than I should.
Well, of course, as you suggest, it's not really so much a matter of individual decision or strategy to reconcile these contradictions, but it will require collective political action.
Yeah, exactly. I interviewed Sam...
Gindin, Sam Gindin.
Yeah, exactly. Sam Gindin, who is such a, like, always the smartest guy in the room. And he was like, look, like, political organizing takes time and labor organizing takes time. And that's one of the reasons that for a long time, the industrial unions fought for reduced hours, not just so people could have a longer weekend, but so that we could be more successful as unions. And so I think that simple point was really important to me, because the time it takes to produce the kinds of lives that, as you said, Livingston and Kathy Weeks are arguing for, and to some extent myself, requires a lot more time to fight for it. It's not going to happen just simply by shortening hours, but by shortening hours and then putting in, you know, the political work to actually enshrine things like Medicare for all and, you know, child care provisions and more paid holidays and more paid sick days and all that stuff. As an activist, I've been involved with some of that. Like, we won paid sick days for Vermonters, not as many as we would have wanted and not as universal as we wanted, but it was something. And that little campaign that I was involved with made me think more about that kind of, you know, politics, I suppose.
And finally, towards the end of the book, you express some skepticism about the zero work, no work, the phrase we can't say on the radio, F work. You think the truth or the desirable goal lies somewhere apart from or short of that, right?
One of the sort of moral or ethical impulses I had to sort of start writing this book was about anti-work politics. And I have a lot of appreciation and love for that perspective. I do think that as it stands now, too often that philosophy ends up being a kind of escapist idea that we can sort of avoid work without really going through it. And so I think that there are a number of policy ideas and politics that come before that that are important to reducing the amount of toil we all have to do. I think there's an interesting connection between universal health care. There's an important connection between increasing union density. And all these kinds of things are sort of on the road to reducing work, which I think is a more material strategy than the sort of work abolition perspective. If there ever is a movement to reduce hours, we should take it very, very seriously. And like, let's go as long as, let's see what we can do. Let's take out as much as we possibly can by eliminating a lot of pointless toil. But there's going to be work that has to be done. And I think that figuring out what to do with that is at the heart of what I'm interested in. And some of that is at the heart of the anti-work ethos as well. I just shied away from that language, I guess, for the most part.
That was Jamie McCallum, professor of sociology at Middlebury and author of Worked Over, How Round-the-Clock Work is Killing the American Dream, just out from Basic. By the way, the full text of the poster he cites about 19 minutes into the interview is, "I didn't go to work today. I don't think I'll go tomorrow. Let's take control of our lives and live for pleasure, not pain." In the version I looked at, those words surround the head and upper torso of someone happily sleeping. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News, back after a musical break. We turn around, so I'm upside down, but all at sea and shut off, drown. Now for torture, off no pain, just like the film of Michael Caine. I've been confused and I've kissed my reflection's shoes. I've been high and I've been low and I don't know where to go. The Sum of Birth, School, Work, Death, a 1988 masterpiece by the Godfathers. And now the emerging Biden national security team, which is looking to be staffed by veterans of the imperial state apparatus who could take us back to the status quo anti-Trump. That's a prospect that establishment types find reassuring. I don't. They include Avril Haines as Director of National Intelligence, Anthony Blinken as Secretary of State, and Jake Sullivan as National Security Advisor. Before looking at the downside, I should say that not all the news is bad. Some of the cabinet choices so far are less disturbing. Biden's nomination of Janet Yellen as Treasury Secretary is, I have to say, pretty good. She did worry publicly about deficits back in 2018, just after the Trump tax cuts took effect, but that was $1 trillion of red ink spilled in service of Make the Rich Richer and nothing else. As Fed Vice Chair from 2010 to 14 and Chair from 2014 to 18, she frequently urged more policy attention to unemployment, low wages, and inequality. She was good in regulation, too, worrying about excessive corporate debt and financial irresponsibility outside the banking system, among other things. She's not about to expropriate the bourgeoisie, but given the plausible list of candidates Biden was going to draw from, she's probably the best. And he could have also done worse than choosing John Kerry as climate czar. Any climate agenda Biden and Kerry are likely to undertake will probably consist mainly of half measures, but that's better than quarter measures, and far better than the actively destructive policies pursued by Trump. For a fairly mainstream look at the emerging national security team, here is Jeff Stein, who has what sounds like a very valuable iPhone. Every now and then I like to step out of my commie bubble to talk with someone who either lives in or closely observes the world of power, and Stein is one of those. There's no need to email me with critiques of Stein's views on Libya or Syria. They're not mine. While I welcome some aspects of Biden's return to normalcy, a dialing down of chaos and hate, especially in the domestic front, I'm much more ambivalent about that return when it comes to foreign policy. Trump's disruptions of U.S. imperial operations were often half-baked and unconsidered, but unlike fomenting white supremacists, undermining the empire is hardly the work of the devil, and bringing back the denizens of Clinton and Obama's foreign policy is hardly the work of the angels. But Stein does have a point when he says that no one, he doesn't use this qualifier, but I'm going to, in the mainstream has any fresh ideas about how to approach the world. So Biden et al. Are going to try to bring back the world before January 20th, 2017. Jeff Stein is a veteran D.C.-based national security reporter who's worked for CQ, The Washington Post, Salon, and Newsweek. Like many journalists these days, Stein is now putting out a newsletter via Substack. You can find it at spytalk.co. Jeff Stein. So let's start with, I want to keep calling, wanting to call her Avril Lavigne, but that's not her name. It's Avril Haines. What do we know about her? What's her background? She's been in this business for a while, right?
Well, she's one of these people that are little known outside of Washington, but are well known inside it. She's been around for a long time, going back years in the Obama White House in several positions, including former deputy CIA director and Obama White House national security advisor. Also, she worked in the legal affairs office at the State Department. She's just a very well-known and highly regarded, I must say, in generally speaking, character in the Washington national security community.
Now, there's some features of her resume, which people on the left, which I must admit that I am, but, you know, like to be open to the facts, will be skeptical. One is her relation with, she did some consulting for Palantir, founded by Peter Thiel, right-wing Trumper. She was very involved in the drone program under Obama. And she supported the nomination of Gina Haspel to be the CIA director, despite her involvement in doing torture. What does this say about her affiliations and what kind of reception she's going to get in Washington?
Clearly, that's going to be a point of contention with liberal and left-wing critics of her nomination. I think when people drill down more, they'll find a more nuanced profile of her. For example, it's been reported fairly widely that she actually was very much a proponent of narrowing down the drone strikes, trying to reduce the possibility of civilian casualties and reduce the number of drone strikes as well. So that's just one point of nuance that I think might soften that criticism of her. She did support Gina Haspel for CIA director, but she wasn't alone in that. I think part of it is the sisterhood, which has struggled long and hard to gain the top posts in the intelligence community. And Gina Haspel, after all, was the first woman to be nominated for the CIA director. So, and she was known as a very professional bureaucrat, you might say, in the operations wing of CIA. But like many, she got caught up in this torture program, which was the avowed, you know, the enhanced interrogation program, as it was called, was the policy of, you know, of the White House. And these CIA people got made sure that everything was tacked down legally for them, or they weren't going to proceed. And then the thing got out of hand. And she's certainly tarred by that. There's no question about that. But she wasn't running a black site. She wasn't directing interrogation programs. So, again, a more nuanced portrait of her lessens the criticism of her, I think. Palantir, that's a big tech program. CIA, Palantir, again, there's lots of reasons to criticize that. I don't know exactly the role she played at Palantir, so I can't comment any more on that. You know, one of the people I quoted in the piece, Catherine Hawkins, in my piece, Catherine Hawkins, who's the senior legal analyst at the Project on Government Oversight, pointed out that also that Avril Haines had a role in the heavy redactions of the Senate Intelligence Committee report on CIA rendition and interrogation programs. And she said to me, I don't think it's comparable to Haspel's direct involvement in torture and refusal to acknowledge it, or even former acting CIA director Michael Morell's record of looking the other way. But still, there are points to be brought up, and certainly Avril Haines will be asked about it at her confirmation hearings. But the Republicans at this point still control the Senate. They will most likely at least control the committees, and she will be confirmed for the very reasons that critics on the left don't like her.
I guess that's the paradox of Washington under the Biden administration. Now, she's going to be she's been nominated for the role of Director of National Intelligence, which makes her the supervisor of 16 intelligence agencies. Why do we have 16 intelligence agencies, and what exactly does the DNI do?
Well, she doesn't have control over the budgets, and she doesn't quarterback them. She doesn't really supervise them. The DNI is somebody, one former or longtime CIA operations officer called it today. It's the Rodney Dangerfield in the intelligence community. It don't get no respect because it doesn't supervise. It doesn't control the budgets. It can't supervise in particular the FBI or the DOD, and those are two of the biggest, intelligence programs we have. The CIA operates semi-independently, more or less independently from the DNI. A number of us over the years have thought that the creation of the DNI was one of the stupidest things the government ever did. I was in rare agreement with the George W. Bush administration saying it was a lousy idea. The same with the creation of the Department of Homeland Security. But it became an imperative after the intelligence failures surrounding the September 11th, 2001 terror attacks, that there hadn't been enough coordination between the intelligence agencies. I'm not sure the DNI has improved any coordination between the intelligence agencies, but there you have it.
Why do we have so many, though? Why do we need 16? Wouldn't it make more sense just to consolidate a few of them?
Well, you would just still have these fiefdoms even if you did. They stand up in relation to their function. For example, the National Security Agency is the electronic eavesdropping arm of the government. It's part of the Department of Defense, actually, statutorily, and it eavesdrops on the adversaries and allies alike.
And move in our conversation, really.
Yeah, it does. It's been statutorily blocked by law from eavesdropping on American citizens, unless there's a terrorism connection. Of course, that we all know that has been abused. But I think if people have an opinion about it at all, they would say, well, it's good to have somebody listening in on our adversaries' military communications and political communications. We don't want another 9/11 or Pearl Harbor. Then we have, the intelligence agencies who operate and process satellite information. You have a defense intelligence agency which tracks adversaries' military order of battle and movements and collects information and tries to get secret information, to obtain secret information on their weapon systems and so on. The CIA does that as well. The FBI, if you want to have me keep doing this roll down, the FBI is involved in domestic counterterrorism and counterintelligence, which is to say thwarting the efforts of foreign intelligence agencies in the United States, as well as domestic terrorism threats. It's been criticized lately for not taking right-wing terrorism threats seriously enough or systematically and bearing down on them systematically. So anyway, that's what they do. They're the internal national security agency.
Okay, so some other members of the national security team are also taking shape. We don't have a nominee for defense yet, right? But Jake Sullivan as national security advisor, what about him? What do you make of him?
Another veteran. The Democrats have a deep bench of national security professionals going back through the Clinton administration. And Jake Sullivan is another one of these. He's squarely in the center of the Clinton-Obama foreign policy national security apparatus. And sometimes people forget that these people are not free agents. There have been relatively few free agents in the intelligence community over the years, I think. The notorious James Jesus Angleton of the 1950s and 60s, who operated virtually independently as the counterintelligence chief at CIA, is one of the most notorious of them. But generally speaking, things that get blamed on the CIA are really, the property of the president. The president checks off on covert action programs. Do they get out of hand? Yeah. Do some of them go beyond what the president understood was going on? Yes, absolutely. But generally speaking, I think responsibility for the operations and policies of the intelligence agencies really has to be put at the foot of the president. And in Joe Biden, you're looking at a longtime Democratic centrist, a Cold War liberal. And I am virtually the same age as Joe Biden now. I've watched him for a long time, and I don't think you can expect any surprises that he's not going to select people of similar sentiment.
I'm speaking with the veteran national security reporter, Jeff Stein.
Okay, now, Antony Blinken, who, of course, is not a spy, although the State Department does have its own internal spy agency as well, but certainly involved in foreign policy issues and national security issues. What do you make of him?
A solid pro. Again, you know, I think if you look at the benchmark of the Trump administration, where incompetent and corrupt toadies were put in positions across the board, his intelligence picks were seemed almost designed to wreck U.S. intelligence, thrown into disarray, chaos, demoralization. And so when you look at Biden, there's this sort of a restoration of, you know, well-known foreign policy, national security professionals that have been around going back to the Clinton administration. Some of the older ones are Cold War liberals. Others are more like Blinken, identified with what you call realpolitik. They have no illusions about the adversarial nature of Russia, China, North Korea, Iran, and so on. But I think they also, from Blinken on down, they are accommodationists. I think they're going to try to cobble back together the Iran nuclear deal. And that's going to be really hard because there's a lot of sanctions to unroll, that the Iranians will want these sanctions rolled back in exchange for reengaging in a nuclear, in a deal that caps their nuclear, their uranium enrichment program. And perhaps because of various events, politically speaking, I think Biden's going to try to get the Iranians to agree to some limits on its missile programs, ICBM programs. That's going to be a heavy, heavy lift, as they say in Washington. So that's going to be hard to do. But I think Blinken and company can be all counted on to try to patch that back together. Certainly they'll, and also to reestablish warm, close relationships with America's traditional European allies, the UK, France, Germany, all the NATO countries, for example. And part of that will be in lifting Iran sanctions because the Europeans want to deal with Iran. They want trade to resume with the Iranians. So again, that will be a pillar of Biden's foreign policy. To patch up these relations with NATO allies, to try to patch together or recobble the Iran deal. They might even, if they have time and some success behind them, try to restore some sort of relationship with the Cubans, although the Cubans are not helping on that front. They have not lessened their oppressive controls of the economy and people's liberties. So that's going to be a hard reach. And also, it deeply offends the right-wing-leaning Cuban-Americans and other Hispanics, Venezuelan-Americans. And Biden and the Democrats are going to have an eye on winning Florida or winning more seats in Florida in the congressional elections, so they don't want to rile up that community. But generally speaking, you're looking at longtime Democratic national security professionals have been around for a long time. Not any surprises.
And then what about China? I mean, when Trump poisoned that relationship with China just by his own palpable racism towards Chinese. But there are also real underlying tensions between the U.S. and China, economic, political, military. So what do you think that the Biden administration approach to China was going to look like?
it's going to be very tough for domestic political reasons as well as realpolitik reasons. The Chinese are very aggressive in the South China Sea, establishing what they feel to be their territory. And they're not going to be pushed back on that, I don't think. And they're also becoming much more militant toward Taiwan. Of course, they've virtually crushed all dissent in Hong Kong. So that's a real tough one. And because of no matter how ill-founded the accusations about Hunter Biden and business there, the Republicans are going to hammer and try to cripple the Biden administration anyway. And Biden's going to be loath to give them a perch by softening China policy. I think you're going to see a disappearance of name calling. I think that's over with. I think Biden's going to try to reach out and establish a respectful relationship with the Chinese, the removal of some tariffs, which, as your listeners surely know, hurts American consumers more than Chinese. I think he's going to look for a working relationship with Xi Jinping, but their eyes are open, and they're not unaware of what's going on with Chinese nationalist forces, meaning Chinese nationalism in the same way that Trump unleashed nationalist populist forces and sentiment here. Xi Jinping has to deal with the same thing in China.
And Blinken was all over the Libya and Syria interventions, supported the actions against Gaddafi, supported aid to the Syrian rebels. He supported Saudi actions against Yemen. Does this signal a return to what Trump calls the forever wars?
You know, I think you have to remember that the Libya and Syria interventions were very popular at the time among liberals, even popular on the left. Dissidents in Syria were being slaughtered by Assad. Gaddafi was out of hand and slaughtering his oppositions. So these were very popular interventions at the time. Of course, people have been around for a long time, arched an eyebrow at this and said, these are easy to get into, not so easy to get out. And that proved to be true. But they were very popular at the time. They just went south, both of them. Obama had sort of a act of coitus interruptus with the Syrian opposition forces. He couldn't really get off the dime. He didn't want to go in big time, which I think was smart, just personally speaking. But then again, that left Assad and, as it turned out, the Russians as well under Trump, a wide open door to crush the opposition. So to answer your question, no, I don't think we're back to forever wars. They're going to be at a low boil in Iraq and Afghanistan for the near future. Of course, other crises are starting to warm up. So, but I think Biden wants to get back to the traditional, dealing with a traditional antagonists in Russia and China. Those are the main goals for him. I think he had no more appetite than Trump, but for different reasons, to get out of Iraq and Afghanistan.
Should we read this as an attempt to restore the status quo anti-Trump? And if that's what it is, have things changed so much in the last 4 years that may not be possible?
Well, you're right on both points. I think it is an attempt to get back to the status quo ante. And of course, the players he's hiring are the people who were the mechanics of the status quo ante. So and I don't think anybody has any fresh alternatives that I know of for retooling a relationship with allies. And of course, Eastern Europe is a different place than it was when Obama was in power. Now you have right wing regimes, neo-Nazi movements, even in Germany, in Germany included. And, the Chinese have advanced more militantly. over the last 4 years. North Korea has continued and advanced its missile and nuclear program, nuclear bomb programs. So there is no ante anymore. I mean, that's gone. The world has changed. I think they just want to get back to some sort of, you know, quiet, kind of moderate, let's manage the world as best we can program. And they'll use the traditional tools for doing that, which is, to, you know, buck up our allies, remain close to them, and, you know, not go off on any other great adventures. You know, the invasion of Iraq and Afghanistan came under Republican administrations. These are not democratic programs, although Obama was sort of trapped in Afghanistan himself. But there's no stomach for staying in Afghanistan, and that's a whole other question. I think there's a great tragedy about to unfold in Afghanistan in that we've created and enabled these urban elites, and especially the advancement of women, and they are not going to do well under the Taliban.
That was Jeff Stein, a veteran national security reporter who's putting out Spy Talk on the Substack platform. I suppose it's reassuring that Avril Haines was a moderate on droning, but I can't say I'm enthusiastically looking forward to the normalization of foreign policy. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, words of wisdom from Stereolab's 1993 Crest, whose lyrics are, in their entirety, though repeated many times, "If there's been a way to build it, there'll be a way to destroy it. Things are not all that out of control. La la la, la 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 la." Till next week, bye.